Welcome, everyone.
Welcome.
You're going to... Sorry, let me take that again. Welcome, everyone, to You're Going to Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about wine and movies.
It's about movies and wine.
For people who don't know shit about one or both, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. You know what actually occurred to me recently is that to many people listening, the description of ourselves as a wine guy and a movie guy is a huge turnoff right away.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Well, because we think it's disarming, right? It's not pretentious. It's very casual. But then, like, to some people, yes. Oh, he's a movie guy. He's going to jack off and talk about Tarantino. And, oh, he's a wine guy. He's just going to have his nose up his own ass about Merlot and Pinot Gris the whole time.
Sure, but then they could just listen to the rest of the podcast. And I don't think that concern is any different if I call myself a sommelier and you call yourself a critic or a film professional.
No, because I'm neither of those things. This is at least more accurate.
Right.
No, I'm just saying, I think for some people, that's like a huge eye rolling turnoff.
That's fair.
That's okay. We'll see you guys later.
Yeah.
Goodbye. You probably didn't get your vaccine anyway, so fuck off. Anyway.
Scotty's pissed. Scotty's fired up today.
It's just every day. I'm so tired of being mad at America. America, we're the greatest country in the world. We've got all the vaccine and nobody wants them. What the fuck?
Well, I mean, a fair bit of people wanted it.
Not enough.
Fewer than we need.
Literally can't pay some people to take the goddamn thing.
Which is insane. Absolute insanity.
And it's a movie and what?
Unvaccinated out there. Stop listening. We don't want you. We don't like you. And you probably don't like us.
And if you think you like us and you don't know that you don't like us, just keep listening. We promise you'll find out. Well, before we get into it, we do have a retraction to make. In our previous episode, James and I were discussing whether or not his describing a certain currently unnamed large-scale California wine producer, describing their methods as making the wine literally in a massive outdoor industrial toilet. We debated whether or not that was libel. And of course, it was not libel. It was slander.
That's correct.
It was slander. And in my brain, while we were having the conversation, I heard the voice of J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson saying, slander is spoken. In print, it's libel.
There it is.
And still, having the voice of J. Jonah Jameson in my brain, I still never actually articulated it on mic. Completely forgot about it through the many hours of editing the episode. And then just a few hours after it went out into the wild, my wife made a point of saying, I need to look up what libel is because I think you guys are using it wrong. And
She
was right.
Yep, yeah. We were using it wrong.
Yep. So Jamie was slandering that wine manufacturer.
Unapologetically, by the way.
It was not libel. It was slander.
I believe it to be true. And in this current climate that we're in right now, my point of view,
you believe it, okay,
whether or not it's based in fact is equally valid.
Well, maybe you'll just get banned from Twitter for 2 weeks for saying this.
That would be great. So for today's episode, excellent segue.
Truly terrible introduction.
We're doing so good today.
Oh, Lordy.
It's a great day. We're starting with a wine that I have known and loved for a long time.
Hang on. We just riffed and did a whole thing, but then we skipped the rest of the introduction.
It doesn't fit. Let's just go.
But maybe that other stuff was bad. Let's at least have options.
Okay. For people who don't know, For people who don't know shit about one or both, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. I already said this. And we're here to help. Each episode, we recommend a movie that I love and a wine that he loves.
And we fill in the gaps you might not already know. Hopefully we find that pairing works. Sometimes we don't. Today, we're starting with a great wine from Oregon. It comes from Maison Noir Wines. This is the Love Drunk Rosé, coming from Willamette Valley, Oregon.
Willamette,
damn it.
Not Willamette.
Correct.
Right.
Literally any Oregonian will correct you.
I believe I've been corrected by Oregonians about this before. Yeah. I know I've been corrected by you about it.
Correct, because I have been corrected by a lot of Oregonians about it.
Right.
It is not Willamette, it is Willamette.
Willamette.
It rhymes with damn it, and that's how you know.
Fair enough. So give us the tiniest bit of a skinny about this wine.
All right. So Maison Noir Wines is the brainchild of Andre Houston Mack, who is sort of a rock star sommelier. The brand was started in 2007. It was originally called Mouton Noir or Black Sheep. It had to be changed to Maison Noir because the first growth Bordeaux property, Chateau Mouton Rothschild, took issue with Mouton Noir.
Mm.
I'm not sure if it actually got to court, but Andre back down and called it Maison Noir. Anyway, the Love Drunk Rosé, the 2020 vintage, is 80% Chardonnay, 20% Pinot Noir, which is what gives it its pink hue. That's the short story. I'll get into some more context on Andre and his exploits in a bit.
I guess we should back up a step. So this is part two of our six-part miniseries, Jamie's Wines of These United States.
Jamie's History of American Wine.
I like my way better, but okay. Jamie's History of American Wine.
Yes.
So I am on the other foot. I am the one doing the pairings for these six episodes. And what words did you give me to describe this wine that might point me towards a pairing?
I gave you magnitude, parentheses, pop, pop.
Pop, pop.
Iconoclastic, constructed, and of maker, not place.
And based on those extremely descriptive words that definitely sound like descriptions of flavor and or sense.
Listen, man, I was trying to give you some cinematic sense here.
But when it all comes down to it, eventually we're going to decide if this pairing worked or not. And I just want everyone to know that it's not my fault because there was nothing in this description that could key me in on the flavor of the wine, which is ultimately the experience that I'm trying to pair to.
Let's stop pretending that either of us actually know what flavor and cinema can possibly have in common. We've hit it 1.5 times.
We've had some successes. I suspect that just like the previous episode in this miniseries, this and the four after it will not be successful pairings.
I disagree. I think this one slaps with The Irishman.
You're stupid. This wine is not The Irishman. So we paired it with The Irishman. Martin Scorsese's 2019. I think a masterpiece, and the guy's got several of those already. It is a quote unquote Netflix original movie written by Steve Zaley and based on the book I Heard You Paint Houses by Charles Brandt. And The Irishman tells the decades-long saga of Frank the Irishman Sheeran, a hitman for the mob who murders his way up the ranks over the 20th century, ultimately finding himself torn between his loyalty to his boss, Russell Bufalino, and to his dear friend, Jimmy Hoffa. It stars Robert De Niro as Frank Sheeran, Al Pacino in an incredible performance as Jimmy Hoffa, and Joe Pesci as Russell Bufalino. It was nominated for 10 Academy Awards. It won none of them. One of those is outrageous. It absolutely should have won Best Visual Effects, but we will get into it.
Let's get into it.
So magnitude. Tell me of the magnitude, Jamie. What in this wine is magnitudinous? Parentheses, pop, pop.
When I said magnitude.
Pop, pop.
Pop, pop. This is referential to Community and the character of the same name, Magnitude.
Magnitude.
Who only says pop, pop.
That's right.
And does he say other things?
I think he only says magnitude, pop, pop.
Magnitude is a portmanteau of magnetic attitude. And I think both Andre Mack and this wine have magnetic attitude. First of all.
Wait, magnitude is a portmanteau?
Yeah.
It's not just like a word?
It's a portmanteau. Well, I mean, it is a word. There's a line in the show. They're introducing magnitude.
Okay. And his magnetic attitude.
Yes.
But you mean the character on Community.
That's correct.
His name is a portmanteau.
That's right.
The word magnitude.
Is a word.
Which is a word.
It's a word.
Is not a portmanteau.
That's correct.
Okay, great.
That has something.
Glad we got that settled.
Right.
All right. Tell me of the magnitude pop pop of this wine.
I mean, it starts with the label.
Okay.
It's undeniable. You want to grab it off the shelf. It's called Love Drunk. It's really well designed. It's stark. It's simple. It grabs your eye. It's black and white. It doesn't give you too much information, which a lot of particularly European labels do. And then the back label gives you basically it's a rosé from Oregon from 2020. That's kind of all you need to know. Then you get it in the glass. And this is like one of the easiest wines to drink that we've covered.
Super drinkable.
Super drinkable.
Yeah. I drank almost an entire bottle in nearly one complete Irishman yesterday.
I finished my bottle far before I was finished with the movie.
Well, you have a higher tolerance than I do.
Yes.
I was pretty drunk by the end of it too.
It's bright. Like there's a little bit of this like fruit salad kind of note to it.
Yeah. It's a medley of fruit flavors.
Yeah.
I was getting pineapple.
There's definitely
some
pineapple.
Serious pineapple flavor.
There's yellow apple. It goes from some of the like red fruits, cherries and that kind of thing all the way to malic fruit and pineapple. And it even gets a little bit tropical, a little like papaya, banana. And it's all about fruit. And Scott just made a groany face because he doesn't know what papaya tastes like.
I don't know what papaya tastes like. I'm not detecting any banana in this. On their website, because I went to the website because I was trying to ascertain more flavor notes. And they said that there are, I have to pull this up now because the description is actually pretty amazing. The 2020 Love Drunk is an intoxicating rosé. Much like new love, it clouds the brain, causes eyes to sparkle, cheeks to glow, blood pressure to rise, and lips to pucker. Not all of these sound appealing, by the way. I don't want a wine that makes my blood pressure go up because my blood pressure is pretty hard these days.
Yeah,
that's true. Here it is. So provocative aromas of strawberry and raspberry, followed by refreshing flavors of wild strawberry, watermelon rind, and a hint of kiwi. Mm. So I'm not getting any strawberry, wild or otherwise, or watermelon rind. And I guess maybe some kiwi. I guess I'm probably getting some kiwi on the finish there.
Yeah, I get kiwi. I think the point that I'm making is that the wine, once it's in your glass, is pretty much undeniable. This isn't a thinker, it's a drinker.
Okay.
There are things to think about it.
Right.
However, it is best served cold and quickly. It's just tasty in basically any circumstance. It is magnetic.
And here we come to, I predict, the first of several issues with our descriptors for this evening. Only now do I realize that you are only using the Community Season 3 supporting catchphrase characters.
I said pop in the damn thing.
Yeah, but you didn't say you were referencing the portmanteau his name derives from, which is magnetic and attitude. You were not actually, I thought you were just making a joke. When you first put that in the spreadsheet, I asked you, I'm like, why does it say pop here? And you're like, I was just being funny because I like Community. But you're actually referencing the character.
That's correct, yes.
And not the definition of the word magnitude, which is a real word and not just a portmanteau.
And means something entirely different.
Okay, great. Cool. Because the reason I picked a 3.5-hour movie about the weight of your life and all your sins and how they bear down on you at the end of your, you know, journey is because of magnitude, not because
magnetic and attitude. Great size or extent of something.
But specifically the great size and extent and the weight of something is why I picked this movie based on magnitude.
Well,
although I think Pacino as Hoffa does actually fit your magnetic and attitude description.
Big time.
It's like a comedic performance. He's so fucking funny.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's very, very big. Yes. My apologies if I wasn't clear.
Great.
The wine has a particular magnetism and attitude to it.
I understand now. Yes, it does. It does have, yeah, it has an attitude and it has a strong personality.
Yes. And Andre Mack himself also has a strong personality and magnetism to him.
All right. Tell me more about Andre and his magnetic personality.
So Andre, before he began his wine career, was a finance guy working in Texas for Citigroup.
Mm, good people.
Really excellent people, not responsible for any poor people's hardship ever.
Right. Certainly not contributing to the financial collapse of this country roughly 13 years ago.
No, definitely, absolutely not.
Cool.
Hands clean.
Right. Definitely didn't offer 18-year-old me a predatory credit card with a fucking 25% APR.
Oh man, the world is terrible. Everything's bad.
Yep.
But this wine is very delicious.
Okay.
Andre left Citigroup not really wanting to have a further career in finance and decided to go into restaurants and wine. He started at The Palm in San Antonio, which for those of you who don't know is a big steakhouse chain. So a really great place to learn about big expensive wines. He transferred from there to another steakhouse in Texas and then ended up working at the French Laundry.
That's Tikal's place,
that's
right?
That's right. Mr. Chef Thomas Keller.
That's what they call him.
Mr. Chef.
I attempted to go there one time.
And failed.
Well, I didn't fail to go there. I attempted to get a reservation and I called 3 months ahead of time, making plans for our Napa honeymoon, not me and Jamie's, my wife and my.
No, it was definitely me and Scott that went to Napa on a honeymoon together. It was beautiful. He laid flower petals down on the bed. We took baths together.
So I called the French Laundry asking for a reservation 3 months ahead of time. And I believe the young woman who answered the phone, I could hear her laughing as the phone quickly slammed back down and hung up on me.
That's excellent hospitality, yeah. TK.
I believe at that time they were 18 months out for reservations. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you guys ended up going, if I recall, to the restaurant at the Meadowood.
Well, we went to a restaurant at Meadowood. And then our last dinner while we were in Napa, we went to Ad Hoc, which is Thomas Keller's other Napa restaurant, which was a dynamite meal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ad Hoc is great.
Super good.
TK is successful for a number of reasons. One of them is that he's a very talented chef.
Also that he was the visual food stylist consultant on Ratatouille, which definitely elevated his profile with the, you know, 8 and under crowd.
Moving right along.
Indeed.
Andre was tapped to do the opening of Thomas Keller's now very famous Per Se in New York City. Andre was the head sommelier there, overseeing a list of a couple thousand selections, developed some very tight relationships with wine growers and winemakers. And that's sort of where his story really begins, because around 2007, after his stint at Per Se, he started Maison Noir Wines, or then called Mouton Noir. It's more than just a wine brand. It's also a style and design brand.
Style like fashion and design like design.
Like design, yeah. You can get like a website designed by them or other apparel specific to you. And Andre is the creative director of his own company.
So they did their own graphics for their bottle label here.
Correct. And yeah. Also for all of the apparel, which mostly is like wine pun t-shirts, but like really, really well done.
How many do you own, Jamie?
I don't own any of them. Although I was looking at them today and was reminded that I want some of them. The one it's Nebbiolo in the Nintendo logo.
That's pretty good.
It says licensed by Nebbiolo.
I'm surprised you don't own that.
Yeah, it's a good crossover of things that I like. There's also a Gruner Veltliner done like Gatorade.
They've got a Master Soms one that is like the logo from Masters of the Universe.
Yep.
IPOP champagne in the style of the IHOP logo.
Yeah, I've seen that one around.
A lot of these are not making a lot of sense.
Yeah, they're wine puns.
They're really wine puns. Yep. Yeah.
The whole point here is that like it's a holistic approach to the company. It's not just the wine, it's everything. It's the design, it's the style, it's Andre himself being the face of the company. His force of personality and friendship with growers and winemakers turn this wine into what it is today, along with the whole line of other Maison Noir line wines.
Is that a common career trajectory for a sommelier to go from restaurants to not starting their own style and influence
to making
brand,
wine, but absolutely, but yeah. Not to this level of success and not on this scale. These are pretty big endeavors that rest in large part on the force of personality of Andre Mack. The one thing I forgot to say in his story and his come up, he was named Best Sommelier in America in 2003. He was the first black man to receive that honor.
Oh, wow.
I've met him once, and it's one of those people. You shake their hand and you're like, oh, this is a special human. Like they look directly into your eyes and like the whole world, there's no one else around.
He was your Gatsby.
And he definitely has no recollection of who I am, because this was back in like 2014 or some shit at a wine event in New York City. But like in addition to this runaway success wine business, he also is about to open a new restaurant in New York City that is fully self-financed and run by him called And Sons. And it is a ham bar, or that's what he calls it.
Okay.
So obviously I'll be there.
I feel like you need to explain this. It's a ham bar.
It's
like
a ham bar.
Pork product.
You go there
bar.
And you eat ham.
Do they also serve alcohol?
Yep.
Is there any other food?
Probably like bread and cheese.
Is it like fancy hams?
Yeah.
All manner
all
of
kind
ham.
Of ham.
This sounds good.
All you have to say to me is Andre Mack and ham bar,
ham
and I
bar.
Will be there.
I feel like all you have to say to you is ham bar.
All you have to there. Say is ham, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's doing that. He also has a wine shop in Brooklyn, I believe, and is the author of a book called 99 Bottles, A Black Sheep's Guide to Life-Changing Wines, and a forthcoming book called Small Time Cooks, time spelled like the herb. It's a coloring and activity cookbook for adults.
You know, I used to rip on adult coloring books for a long time. I
yes,
thought they
did.
Were stupid and needless mm-hmm. and like learn to
I
do art
you
or
condescending
something.
Condescending about this a lot.
Yeah.
And go on.
Well, in the last year, I've spent a lot of time coloring with a small child.
Yes.
And coloring is extremely soothing, I've mm-hmm. discovered.
That's the whole thing that these people were saying. The whole time is that it's soothing.
I guess I just never listened to them. I just saw adult coloring books and rolled my eyes because it sounded stupid.
People find things soothing.
Yeah. Anyway, adult coloring books.
Adult coloring books.
You have my thumbs up now.
Yes. And Andre Mack, you have my thumbs up with your magnetic attitude. So Scott is probably going to justify why he chose this movie by the literal definition of magnitude as the great size or extent of something.
That is correct.
And once again, I apologize, Scotty, for not being clear.
Well, it's fine. It's fine. You know, words have meaning, Jamie. You're out there all being a descriptivist and I'm over here like with the dictionary and talking about what words mean. Magnitude. So if you know anything about The Irishman, you probably know two things. You know that it has digital de-aging effects to make a bunch of 70-year-old men look kind of younger. and you know that it's 3.5 hours long. That's basically all anyone knows about it.
I didn't even know any of that when I went into it because
you didn't know it was 3.5 hours long.
Well, you told me that.
Right.
I didn't know anything about the de-aging at all.
But you'd seen a trailer for it.
You're putting a lot more stock into how much attention I pay to things than perhaps you should.
Fair. Anyway, so it's long.
It's super.
It is 3.5 hours long. People complained about it a lot.
Never mind. And I also have complaints about the runtime.
Right, because you're basic. That's okay. You're basic, Jamie.
It's long.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I ain't got 3.5 hours to watch this movie. I've got TikTok to scroll, all right?
Exactly. So you can spend 3.5 hours scrolling TikTok and stalking on the Zoomers who have already moved on to something else because of creepy people like you who are creeping on them.
You just got to hate on people doing things that make them happy. At first it was adult coloring books. Now it's TikTok.
All right. Adult coloring books, I thought were dumb. And now I kind of get it. But you're out there being Jamie, spying on the young people and creep.
You know, most of the accounts that I follow are like Gen X and or
all the young people left because of you, Jamie.
They're still there.
So The Irishman is not short.
It is long.
That is correct. I do not find it to feel long. Hmm. I had even conversations with some like film professionals who I had worked with about whether or not Scorsese earned the long runtime. I feel that he as a filmmaker has earned our trust with a 3-hour runtime. And I think the movie earns it because the runtime is part of the storytelling. So the movie is about Frank Sheeran's life, the accumulation of his life and his experiences and his details and his relationships. All of that over the course of this lengthy 3.5-hour film pays off in the end. By the way, spoilers, everyone, for The Irishman. The final half hour of the movie, after Frank has done the dirty deed and has betrayed his best friend, Jimmy Hoffa, the last half hour to 40 minutes of the movie is Frank aging very rapidly.
Very rapidly.
Right.
So sometimes in prison.
He deals with, or he barely deals with, the weight and the guilt about having killed his friend Jimmy, but then he goes to jail. He very, very quickly ages. Pesci, Buffalino, ages very, very quickly. And then the movie reveals to you what it's really about, which is about how you look back on your life and you look back on your sins and you look back on your relationships and the weight of all of your deeds, good and bad. All of that in that last half hour, I'm thunderstruck by it. It sucks the life out of me. Like, it's depressing and it's heartbreaking and it's devastating. That last half hour doesn't work if everything prior to it isn't lengthy. You need the accumulation of the nuance and all the details of the relationships for that to pay off.
Yeah, there's nothing that I would cut out of this movie.
Right.
There's nothing that I think you could or should.
So is the movie long, is my question to you?
Yes, it's fucking long.
Is it?
Yes. I'm not saying the movie is long as a criticism of the movie.
Right.
I'm just complaining that I had to sit there for 3.5 hours, which is like a long time to sit there and do one thing in our like mile a minute ADHD culture. Right.
Okay. I think it's a gift, but go on.
It's an investment. It's a large portion of your day.
It is an investment. That is true.
And here, I've got a good example. I've got a good wine crossover here.
Okay.
So a good analog for that might be Amarone, which is a wine famously high alcohol. And we've drew this parallel in a previous episode that didn't make the cut. I don't think so. Well, I have said before that, you know, we talk about short movies being great a bunch.
Yeah.
We've said it, you know, bless the 85-minute movie.
Right. It is a gift to us all.
And wine people love a low-alcohol wine also.
Right.
It's less of a commitment. You can have an 11% wine and then, like, go about your day. So Amarone, famously high alcohol, it is not Amarone if it's not high alcohol. It contributes to the overall experience of the wine. It is fundamental to the thing.
Okay.
So is Amarone's high alcohol a critique of the wine? No. But do I always want to drink it? Also, no. It's a particular time and place kind of thing.
Okay.
I can't handle a bottle of Amarone because I will get alcohol poisoning. And sometimes I simply don't have the time for a 3.5-hour movie.
But it's not too long. You're not saying it's too long.
No.
You think it's the appropriate length, but you're going to whine about it anyway.
Correct.
Okay, great. Cool. I don't think it's too long because I think every minute is compelling. I think the characters are all great. The performances are all great. The whole critique, the complaint that it's too long is like, I don't know, man, this movie came out 7 months after Avengers Endgame and that was fucking 3 hours long. And
right. An extra half hour when you're talking about 3 hours.
Right.
It feels like a nitpick.
That said, people did complain about that movie a lot, mostly because they were going to have to hold their bladders, which is like, fucking just hold your bladder. Be an adult. Hold your bladder.
Yep.
Or live with it and miss part of the movie.
Or pee in your chair like an adult. Own it.
as someone who used to be responsible for theaters where that happens sometimes, that's not funny. And that's not even the grossest thing that happened in our theaters.
Dude, I worked in restaurants. Don't start.
I'm Jamie. I worked in restaurants. The industry is the hardest thing of all. Oh, there's a fly in my wine.
It's protein. That's extra protein. It's good for you.
It's still alive.
Poor guy. He's probably having a good time.
Excuse me, waiter, mister, I worked in restaurants. There's a fly in my wine. I would like another glass,
please. It's extra protein.
I'm not drinking it. It's also still alive.
I'll get you more wine.
I can see its wing flutters vibrating in the glass. Jamie's going to get me another bottle. I'm going to press pause.
Okay.
All right, we're rolling again. We're back in. So magnitude.
So yeah, it's long.
It's long. I think the long is good. I think it's important. I will say for our audience at home, if you have not watched the movie already, what are you doing here? Go watch the movie. But also, and this is just for the parents, all right? As a parent, I recognize that parents do not have 3.5 hours to watch a movie. The rest of you, fucking bite me. You have that time. You're going to fucking binge watch the first 10 episodes of Stranger Things in one night. You can watch The Irishman. But for parents, it's hard.
It's so hard. Parents are the only people who are busy.
We just have less time to do the things that we want than you guys do.
You made your bed, lie in it.
And I do, but I will say that I have less time to do the things that I want.
That's fair.
So for the parents and for no one else out there, if you cannot watch 3.5 hours in one evening, Jamie might be a parent. He doesn't know. He'll find out someday. around the 1 hour, 40 minute mark, and this, I can't take credit for this. Twitter user at Dooner4s, very unpopularly posted in November of 2019. I created a viewing guide for everyone who thinks The Irishman is too damn long in one night. But so this guy gave 4 chapter stops for how you can watch The Irishman as a miniseries. I personally find that offensive. So does Mr. Scorsese. But I will say for the parents, you can watch it in 2 viewings instead of 4 viewings. And around the 1 hour, 40 minute mark, cut when Joey the Blonde is introduced. And that is a nice, clean split point.
When I watch the movie, pause wherever the fuck you want.
No.
Everyone's busy and needs to make time for things. And let's stop being so far up our own ass.
No.
And just enjoy whatever experience you get.
All right. So, Jamie, let me explain to you. When I had this wine the other day, I had a little bit of it in a solo cup and I let it sit out in the sun and it warmed. And then later on, I poured that into a mug and then I put that in the microwave so it could maintain the same temperature. And then I put some ice cubes in it. Now, let me tell you my opinions about the wine, which are totally legitimate.
So you're saying that pausing at any point other than an hour and 40 minutes into the movie and breaking up your viewing experience like that is akin to microwaving a wine?
Yes.
Okay. We're just on fundamentally other planes of existence.
Pacing is important.
I know pacing is important.
This is a carefully edited and constructed movie. The pace of it is part of the experience, as with all movies.
But also, if you want to drink your wine out of a solo cup, drink your wine out of a fucking solo cup.
What about with ice cubes?
It's fine.
It's fine?
And the French call it a la piscine.
You heard it here, everybody. Jamie says it's fine if you want to drink your wine out of solo cups with ice cubes. It is all A-okay by him.
It's good to go.
We'll share it on the socials if people want to break it up in multiple viewings. But I would say if you need to split it into 2 nights, there is a good organic place to break up the movie, which is roughly around the 1 hour, 40 minute mark when Joey the Blonde, that character, is introduced. Pick it up there the next night and you have a very organic place to pause it where the story is kind of bisected in a way that makes sense.
But not in 4 parts as Twitter user, whatever his name, suggested.
Yeah, I mean, you could do that too. I just think it's a movie. You can watch a 2-hour movie and then like a slightly less than 2-hour movie the next night. You can do it. And if you can't, what are you listening to this fucking hour-long discussion of movie and wine for?
That's fair.
This is an hour of your life you're never getting back.
Okay, constructed.
Constructed.
Yes.
How is this wine constructed?
All right, so
not just how is it constructed, but does constructed mean in a wine again?
Why am I using the word constructed?
Yes.
Yeah. I use the word constructed when I want to talk about the winemaking process.
Okay.
How the winemaker has a greater significance in a wine's life than the place that it comes from. So this wine is, as I said at the beginning, 80% Chardonnay and 20% Pinot Noir. That is a really uncommon way to make rosé.
What is a common way to make rosé?
Well, there are 2 very common ways. The first is called maceration, which is basically like you're about to make a red wine, but instead you press off the skins earlier.
And you would do that with just like a Pinot Noir?
Right. Yeah, you'd crush the grapes, Let them sit for a while, get a little bit of color, get it pink, and then press. That's a very oversimplified thing, and there are a lot of...
That's fine.
The other way is called saigne, S-A-I-G-N-E, accent aigu E, which means bled. So the idea is you're making a red wine and you want to make a darker red wine. So you bleed extra juice off that has low color in order to make a very concentrated red wine and some byproduct rosé.
Okay. Let me see if I understand enough here to track. So it's uncommon for someone to make a rosé by using mostly a white grape and then adding a red grape.
That's right.
Okay. I've solved it, everybody. We figured it out. Wine has been solved. I got it.
You did a really good job.
For everybody out there who feels like they're me, being a complete moron listening along to the show, not understanding anything that Jamie is saying and just trying to keep up and maybe making a fart joke once in a while, this is a victory for all of us. We all just won a little bit here.
We haven't done a fart joke this episode.
Yeah, I mean, you just farted a few minutes ago.
Yeah, but it wasn't on mic.
That's true.
Anyway.
Yes.
The blending method, which is what this is not common, where you have a red wine, Pinot Noir, and a white wine, and they're blended afterwards to make a rosé. The only place that that's really like super common is champagne. Most champagne rosé is done via blending method. It's actually illegal in the rest of France to make a blended rosé. It's either maceration or saigne.
Briefly, why is it illegal?
We're not going to go into why it's illegal because then I'll get mad about French people being French. But
it's just a dumb reason.
You shouldn't stifle creativity. Like this is a good fucking wine. It's undeniable. And if other places were allowed to do this, we would have other good wines.
Okay.
The French are prescriptivist, not just in their language, but also in their terroir. And it's a fucking pain in the ass. They should stop it. But they won't because the wines are really good and they, you know, sell very well and they're very expensive. Because capitalism is reinforcing bad behavior.
Right.
Anyway, this is a wine that's made. It's not grown, is my fucking point. Laugh at me.
I thought you were reaching for profundity. I apologize. It's because it's a blend.
Because the winemaker's imprint, because the intent is there. We talk so much in wine about terroir and a sense of place and letting the we call them wine growers even, as opposed to grape growers, right?
Oh yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's a hint to this process being largely not a thing that people do. First of all, I don't think that that's true. I think that agriculture in its baseline is a profoundly unnatural occurrence. And then winemaking is a whole other thing that we do. This wine runs counter to the idea that the land gives you the wine. This is, you take the pieces, you put them together, you construct the wine.
Okay. That seems reasonable.
That's why I use the word construct.
Constructed.
And you can feel it in the flavor. It's
okay. That's my question. How does that translate to this being tasty?
Well, you heard me talk about red fruit and like cherries and pomegranate in the beginning, but also tropical fruit and palm fruit and pineapple and like kiwi and papaya and all of that.
Right.
And that the red fruit, pomegranate, cherry part, that's Pinot Noir. The other stuff, the yellow fruit, I would call it, is Chardonnay. And that's why you really don't see a lot of rosés that taste like this, because most rosés are exclusively red grapes. What about that movie?
About how it's constructed?
Yeah.
There's two things about it that I think are constructed. One is just how the narrative is constructed, right? Which is that double nested frame narrative. And when I say a frame narrative, I mean a flashback structure, right? A frame around the main story when we start with Frank in the beginning and then we end with old Frank at the end and everything that's in between is flashbacks. And in this movie, it's two frame narratives because it's old Frank in the nursing home and it's slightly less old Frank and slightly less old Russell in the car on the way to Detroit. And then we keep flashing back from there as well. And I think that construction is great. Scorsese and his longtime brilliant editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, work magic together. But the way that this thing, it just flows so effortlessly. You don't even have to think so much about the time jumps or trying to keep the narrative or the multiple timelines or the multiple voiceovers straight because it all just plays so organically. And it feels effortless, even though it requires an extraordinary amount of effort to keep all of that straight and to figure out the best, most natural way to tell that story.
Yeah, I was a little worried the first time the second frame happened.
Right.
I was like, oh God, now I have to pay attention and it's going to be 3.5 hours of this shit. Yeah. But it ended up not being a problem.
So I love that level of construction. And then the other way that it's constructed is the performances are constructed. The three lead performances, De Niro, Pesci, and Pacino, they're all characters who are depicted over many decades, and they are all digitally de-aged. And it's this like quantum leap in digital de-aging and motion capture performance technology. And in many, but not all of the shots in the movie, you are not looking at Robert De Niro. You are looking at a digital character of Robert De Niro.
That's pretty incredible.
It's unbelievable. How much do you know about how motion capture is done? Like performance capture?
A little bit. I know about the green balls.
So there's the green balls or the little white dots, right? Where all of this started is motion capture is the green dots or the white dots on someone's body to track their skeletal motion. And that's recorded with a separate infrared camera. And those little white dots on their body are being hit with like infrared rays. And then there's multiple capture cameras in a three-dimensional space to capture the full skeletal movement. So you can input that into a computer. And then that drives the body performance, right?
Right.
That's motion capture. Performance capture is the same concept, except it's little white tracking dots all over the actor's face at key points. There's, I think, 36 of them. And then the same idea, an infrared camera captures all of that information simultaneous to the cinema camera capturing just like the plate, like the actual scene and the actor. And so then that's how somebody like Andy Serkis can be a CGI gorilla or a CGI chimpanzee in the Planet of the Apes movies.
Right.
They have his performance interacting with other people. They take him out of the image and then they take the digital ape character that has now the telemetry from his body and his facial performance mapped onto a different character. A lot of what they do in these movies now is that they have the dots and then the actor has to wear a helmet, like a headset with a capture camera that is a super wide angle lens camera that's about 6 inches from their face and captures the entire performance up in close up.
Cool.
There's no dots in The Irishman. They didn't put any little dots all over anybody's faces. Scorsese, when he was talking with the visual effects supervisor from ILM, was saying like, I got De Niro and Pacino and Pesci. Like, I can't have these guys covered in dots all over their faces. Like, it's just not going to work. The whole movie's about these intimate relationships and performances. It's going to be ridiculous. They're not going to buy it. And so the ILM folks went back and they had a couple of years to figure this out. And they came up with a way to do it with no facial tracking dots whatsoever. So there's no tracking markers on their faces. There's no head-mounted capture camera. All they have are four, basically invisible to the camera, infrared tracking dots that are hidden on the corners of their faces. For the filming of any de-aged scene where one of these characters has to be younger, they used what they called the three-headed beast, which is their 4K cinema camera with two infrared witness cameras mounted on either side of it, which meant that also if they were shooting a scene, like Scorsese loves shooting multiple cameras at a time for dialogue scenes, so he might have a master and a close-up and a close-up, mm-hmm. which meant that they would have 9 cameras running on any given scene that was being filmed that way. 3 cinema cameras and 6 infrared cameras. And then the infrared cameras, by having them spatially to left and right, you can capture that information in 3 dimensions. The infrared witness cameras, because there's no shadows in infrared imagery, it picks up all of the details in a person's face. They're able to map that onto a full 3D scan of each of those actors' faces that they use to build out anatomical models. All of those shots that were needed to be de-aged were ran through what they called the Flux system, which is just a facial animation and a lighting program to analyze the facial performance based on a 3D model that they made, map that performance onto the new younger face model, and then they light it and texture it correctly with accurate light scattering, like subdermal light scattering, how blood flows in your flesh based on what expression or what your emotion is at the time. Like if you're angry, they know that your blood flow is different in different parts of your face, and then the correct skin texture. They made younger versions of De Niro, Pacino, and Pesci that they thought they were going to have to use this extensive like reference library from those guys' other works. But then as they looked at it, they were able to determine that like, well, in 1976, De Niro looks absolutely nothing like he does in 1978 in The Deer Hunter. So there is no like platonic ideal of Robert De Niro at age 30 or at age 40. So we're just going to make a younger version of this character.
Right.
We're making a younger version of Frank in his 70s, and that will make the young version where he's like 50 or 30.
So it's pretty damn cool.
It's wild. And because look, the big complaint about the de-aging in the movie is that it doesn't look convincing. And like, I think it looks real. It never looks anything less than real. They just don't look like Like, we know what Robert De Niro looked like when he was in his 30s, right? He doesn't look like that.
Right.
But it's convincing enough. He looks like a real person. And it is no less distracting than hiring a younger actor to play him at different stages in his life.
That's correct.
And it's much less distracting than trying to do it with makeup.
Also true.
You still have some kind of artifice to it, but you get the emotional continuity of having these masterful actors carry you through.
That's what I was going to say. I was like, it is not a perfect option.
No.
There is something uncanny about it. There's something that, you know, we can tell.
Yeah.
The jig is up.
Right. Especially when they have to start moving and doing the action.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they're old men.
They're old men. They're not young.
It's an incredible effect. And I honestly, I had no idea that it was digital. You know, I thought that it was makeup watching it.
Yeah.
Which is a testament to the photorealism of it.
Yeah. Of maker.
Not place.
Not place.
Making wine is frequently about expressing place. We talk about it an awful lot.
Terroir.
Exactly.
Yes.
I would argue that people are the most important part of the places that these things come from, and therefore have a tremendous impact on the wines. Andre Mack here is not at all shying away from that reality. This wine is specifically made to be love drunk rosé. It is not purporting to be an expression of the basalt soils of the Dundee Hills of Willamette Valley. Frequently, the highest height that a winemaker can achieve is that he has expressed the place fully. Well, Andre here is expressing his own personality. I kind of think it's bullshit to say that place is more important than people. I very much identify with this attitude.
If this were a rosé that was more interested in expressing the Willamette Valley,
yes,
terroir, what might that taste like?
It would for sure be 100% Pinot Noir. It would likely be a designated single vineyard. So from a small specific plot of land, it would taste like pomegranate and cranberry. It would be a little bit higher acid. There would be a lot of minerality to it. This wine goes the other direction and sort of isn't interested in minerality. It's interested in fruit. And there's another thing that I really respond to. Fruit's good. We like fruit. Tastes good.
Yeah.
I think we can all get behind the idea that fruit tastes good.
Can we have more wines on this show
that tastes like fruit?
That tastes like fruit and thus tastes good.
You bet.
Okay, cool. I'm not looking at you.
No, you are.
Bonnie Doon's Le Cigar Blanc. But I, if there were a bottle here, I would be casting aspersions at him.
And also Valdespino Innocente.
Yeah, that did not taste like fruit.
In the wine community, we think of like minerality and earthiness and like tertiary, like oxidative components as the things that we really want to chase and the markers of like quote unquote complexity. But like, for fuck's sake, fruit tastes good and we should drink wine that tastes like fruit.
Jamie, top five fruits right now. Go.
Wow. Okay.
Go, so right now.
Apples, cherries. I'll be more specific. Honeycrisp apples.
Okay. I agree. Honeycrisp is the best apple.
Honeycrisp is the best apple.
Yeah.
So, so good. Rainier cherries. Mission figs, which may be a hot take, but I think that they're quite delicious.
Okay.
Fresh in-season Mission figs.
Fresh Mission figs.
Yep. Tomato. Fresh in-season tomatoes.
God, you're so iconoclastic, Jamie, that you had to go with tomatoes, which are conventionally thought of as vegetables because they're savory and not sweet.
Tomatoes are fucking delicious.
Five, Jamie. You're at four. What's five? What's number five?
Strawberry.
Strawberry.
The strawberry. Oh, you know what? I'll take fig off in favor of peach.
Peach?
Yeah.
I could eat a peach for hours.
I also could eat a peach for hours.
I could eat a peach for hours.
Really, really good. Yeah. So peaches and strawberries, Rainier cherries, Honeycrisp apples.
All good.
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
Heirloom tomatoes.
Heirloom tomatoes. Yeah.
Top five fruits. So yes, fruit tastes good.
Fruit tastes good. Of maker, not place.
So talk to me about The Irishman. There's a lot about place in this movie.
Oh, I'm not interested in that.
You're not interested in the place.
No, because that's not what that's not why I did that. The maker is Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Director of films, director of cinema that plays in movie theaters.
Right.
He makes movies that look like movies.
Yes.
The place is Netflix.
Ah.
We're the only ones who are going to pony up the, they say, $150 million budget. It probably costs more. That digital de-aging shit is not inexpensive, nor is it inexpensive to shoot in 295 locations.
What?
Their location scout put 5,000 miles on his car tracking down all of the places that they were going to shoot in this movie. 295 sets or locations where they filmed this movie.
That's a lot of places.
And some of it for like one shot. Very expensive movie to make. Scorsese has, especially earlier in his career, struggled to get the appropriate budget and to get projects off the ground. After Goodfellas, he had much less difficulty getting many projects made. But this movie, with a cast of 70-year-old men and its lengthy runtime that he wouldn't budge from, none of the studios would go for it at a price tag of $150 million.
Right.
So it was just Netflix. Netflix is, for all of its faults, they're the only place right now that is bankrolling big, expensive, interesting work from some of the greatest filmmakers in this country and in this world.
So this movie is of maker and place then?
No, because it's not like a Netflix movie. Just visually, Netflix has sort of a house style that they impose on all of their original TV shows, or most of their original TV shows, and on most of the movies that they bankroll. There's a visual look. Certain colors are very saturated and certain colors aren't so saturated. Contrast is depressed. Black levels tend more towards gray than into like deepest possible black. And it's all about making something that will look not great or perfect the way that the filmmaker wants, but that will look good on basically every device. Netflix wants it to look good on your iPhone and they want it to look good on your TV. It's not going to look great on all of them, but it'll look good and the same on everything.
Right.
This movie does not look like that. It doesn't conform to their house like algorithm that decides what is the best picture compression image ratio, right? This movie is not that. This is a masterwork. This doesn't feel like something that's just okay and just being passed off, even though like it's Martin Scorsese, like the one of the great champions of cinema. And he made something with a company that could be considered like the enemy in a way, but they're the only ones who are going to make it. And they gave it a theatrical release. It had a 3-week exclusive theatrical release in the US before it dropped on Netflix. It is a Netflix movie. You cannot deny it. I can make my little jokes about it being a quote unquote Netflix original just because I find that branding fucking obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still 100% a Martin Scorsese movie. And if you took the Netflix off the front of it and put Paramount or Warner Brothers, it would sit just as well there. Whereas if you took most of the Netflix product that comes out, if it was released by another studio, you would say, oh, what went wrong here? Like, why does this look the way that it does? Why does it look like television? Why is it so gray and flat in the image? But on Netflix, it makes perfect sense because it's just fine. It's a Netflix movie. It's fine. You see that new thing that came out on Netflix? Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was fine. It was okay. It was fine. That's how I feel about that.
So iconoclastic.
Iconoclastic. James.
So we touched on it a little bit when we were talking about Magnitude, when you asked if it's common for Soms to become winemakers. And I said, yes, it's not hugely, hugely common, but it is unheard of for them to see this level of success and this broad an appeal. Andre's wines are breakout wines. They're for everybody. Love Drunk Rosé sells out every single year. And I don't know how much is made, but it's not a small amount. The first one he made was called OPP, which you may remember from a hip hop song.
I may remember. Jamie, can you give a couple bars to the listener who maybe is not as familiar with old school hip hop as you are?
I'm not dropping bars.
Come on, drop some bars.
The song is called OPP.
Come on.
You down with OPP? Yeah, you know me.
There you go.
And in that song, it's other people's property. In Andre Mack's case, it's other people's Pinot.
Ah, clever.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that.
And I've drunk a fair bit of that. And it's a Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. The price of that particular category has been high and continues to raise, yet you can still get OPP for $25 a bottle. And it remains a very high quality wine. These are very much for the people. And this is the thing that doesn't happen in addition to coupling a wine brand with a style and a design brand. And that is why I would say that Andre Mack is iconoclastic.
I don't understand.
What don't you understand?
He makes good wine and they're inexpensive and that's iconoclastic?
Good inexpensive wine is anomalous.
Okay.
On a large production level.
Then I guess I don't understand. What about this wine is so good compared to other wines at its price point? Like, do other people make wines comparable to this that cost way more money?
other people make wines comparable to this that are maybe comparable in price, but are a tenth of the production level. By production level, what I mean is how much wine is made. We've talked on previous episodes and we've run into the problem that we just run out of wine
right.
a bunch. Because I like wines that are artisanally produced, that are a little bit more thoughtful and soulful.
Mm-hmm.
And what's different here is that we're taking that sort of art and soul and applying it to a large scale.
At scale.
Yeah.
I see. Did you say that previously?
I believe I did, but you're going to find out in the edit. It's the only brand I know of that really does it like this, that has this kind of attitude that makes wine of this quality at this scale.
But you don't know how much wine he makes.
No, it's not a small amount.
Is it a large amount?
I don't know numbers.
Okay. But it's a large amount.
It's yes. It's everywhere. Okay. It's literally everywhere.
So people could go to like a store and buy this.
Yes.
Like any store.
This is in Pennsylvania state stores right now.
And those are pretty restrictive comparatively.
Right. And typically they favor large production wines because our listeners may not know this. Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board is the second largest purchaser of alcohol in the world.
Are they number two after Costco?
No, they're number two after the Liquor Control Board of Ontario.
So he's an iconoclast.
Yeah.
But also the style. And the branding.
Yes.
Speaking of the style and the branding, can you explain something to me? What is this garage door thing that's written on the cap wrapper thing?
Yeah. So on the neck of the bottle, it says garage door.
It's garage door en français. So
it says garage door hyphen Oregonia.
Right.
O-R-E-G-O-G-N-E. These are both references to French wines. A vin de garage is a term for specifically wines from Bordeaux that started in the early 90s that were literally made in garages. They would source a tiny amount of fruit and make micro lots of wines with huge amounts of new French oak on them. And they were called garagistes. Andre sort of tongue in cheek is saying that this is a garage wine because it's his startup company. The door part, D apostrophe O-R.
Of Oregon.
Is of Oregon. It's also in French of gold. Mm. The cote door in Burgundy is the golden slope. So it's a reference to Burgundy, which is always referenced when fucking people get talking about Willamette wine. Because Willamette sits on the same latitude. And then Oregonia. Once again, O-R-E-G-O-G-N-E, Oregon, but spelled like Bourgogne, the French word for Burgundy. He's just being referential.
But is that also a little iconoclastic? Because he's being pretty tongue-in-cheek.
He's
taking swings at the big boys in Burgundy.
And it's part of the reason why he originally named the company Mouton Noir.
Right.
Like, yes, it's black sheep. He's a little bit of an outcast. He's not, you know, your normal sommelier. But also, it was a reference to Mouton Rothschild. And so they were a little bit right to take issue.
Yeah, they had beef.
So yeah, the tongue-in-cheek attitude, all of this ties in to the personality of Andre Mack and the personalities of these wines. So what about the Irishman is iconoclastic? Or is Marty iconoclastic?
No, the I picked the movie for iconoclastic because the movie is in conversation with other mob movies, in particular his mob movies. And in some readings of it, it is a refutation of those mob movies.
Huh. We talked earlier about how I haven't seen The Godfathers or...
Right. Or Goodfellas.
Or Goodfellas.
Right. So I'm just talking to the audience here at this point.
I mean, I saw The Departed.
Which is, I wouldn't consider that one of his mob movies. Like the mob is in it, but like it's... That movie is...
So what are his mob movies?
So... You could say that Mean Streets, which was like his first big feature, is a mob movie. There's like a criminal element to it.
Okay, which I also haven't seen.
And then you've got your Goodfellas,
mm-hmm.
Casino.
Right.
Arguably The Departed. I don't think that's a mob movie. That's a cop movie. And then The Irishman.
Cool.
This movie is loaded with references to not only Scorsese's mob films, but also a lot of other movies in the great mobster canon. This movie is, among other things, it's him looking back on his own body of work. The project originated with him and De Niro wanting to re-team again and trying to find a project to talk about their own aging. and the way that they're looking back on their lives and looking back on their work. And they were circling another project. And then De Niro read the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, which is written by a former prosecutor who became the attorney of the real life Frank Sheeran, who tells this story. He was the first person who ever said, I know what happened to Jimmy Hoffa. I killed him. Historians have taken issue with it. It seems like Scorsese and De Niro are less interested in presenting factual reality than they are in this compelling story of this old man telling his own tale. Like from the very beginning, we're just watching Frank tell his own story, right? Right. It's so subjective. It's him telling a story within telling a story. They're looking back on a life. They're looking back on their own body of work. And the tone of this movie is so at odds with his former mob movies, like Goodfellas and Casino, which are very high energy, very staccato, rapid fire editing. They show you the glitz and the glamour of mob life. They also show you the violence and the degradation of it. But like you get the fat stacks of cash and the furs and the women and the cars and all that crazy stuff and the thrill of it all. And this movie is not that. This movie is talking to those films. It's why the whole movie has like this very neutral color palette. It's very mundane. It's very grounded. It's very lived in. This is not trying to be that. This is in a way like a wiser, older man looking at maybe his other works and saying, maybe this is the way that we should have depicted it. Scorsese has taken issue with this characterization of the movie. He did an interview during press for the film with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, and she compared the opening shot of this movie, which as we've described is a tracking shot, very slow through the nursing home to find Frank Sheeran, as everyone has compared it to the very, very famous oner in Goodfellas, where Henry Hill taking his date, Lorraine Bracco, into the Copacabana, one of the most famous one shots of all time. The Steadicam follows them past the crowds, down the stairs, through the kitchen, up into the nightclub, and then they get a seat right up in the front row, and it's super sexy and romantic, and it's Henry romancing her and sweeping her off her feet. And Terry Gross compared that shot to the opening of this film and asked him, like, are you calling out your other movie by saying, like, this is the real life that these guys should have led? Like, this is the eventuality of Goodfellas. And Scorsese was somewhat taken aback and said something to the effect of, I knew that the gangsters were bad when I made that movie. I'm not regretting what I said before, but it's hard not to make that comparison.
Right.
And especially with all of the references to not just his mob films, but other mob films. Compare the scene where Frank's first job that he does for Hoffa is when he goes to Chicago and he blows up a bunch of taxis, right? Very, very similar to a scene early on in Goodfellas when young Henry Hill blows up a bunch of cars at like a used car lot. Except in that movie, it's super sexy and exciting. Henry Hill sets the explosives. He's running away from the car lot in slow motion with the camera really low. And then as the explosion goes off behind him, he's super thrilled. And the movie freeze frames on this image. It's just a job for Frank. He's super detached, right? The movie never tries to get you into the romance of the mob. It's just his job. The scene where Frank is picking out his weapons for the crazy Joe Gallo hit, He lays out all the guns on the bed, Is an explicit callback to Taxi Driver. When Travis Bickle goes and meets with a gun salesman and they're in a motel room and they lay out a bunch of guns on the bed and Travis picks out the right ones. Even the title card. So the movie will repeatedly stop. Sometimes it'll freeze frame, sometimes it won't. But it'll put a title card on screen whenever we meet a new, like, ancillary character. And it'll say their name and then
just shot in the head and Date of death.
Describe their death. So this is the freeze frame is a device that he used a lot in Goodfellas and in Casino and in Wolf of Wall Street, which is just a gangster movie, but with, penny stocks instead of pistols. He's using the same technique, but here it's underlining the mortality of everybody. We don't see most of these characters die. And it's also like, it's an old man telling you this story. And if you ever sit down with an old person and they tell you a story, when they come to a character, no matter how unimportant to the story, they will invariably tell you if they have to, oh yeah, and that's when Jim came along and but Jim died some years later. He got hit by a bus or he had angina. Like it's using the same device to put you in the frame of reference of those earlier movies, but using it a way to underline the constant mortality and the danger and the amorality that the character himself will never actually address. And then the one that gets me the most is when Frank and Russell are basically we've caught up to the present in our flashbacks, right? We're no mm-hmm. longer flashing back. Now it's right after the scene when Frank calls Hoffa and Pacino, when he takes the phone call, is sitting on a deck in like an Adirondack chair, right?
Yeah.
This is an explicit call out to Godfather Part Two, which Pacino playing Michael, spoilers for Godfather Two. I'm sorry, everyone. And I'm sorry, Jamie, Michael, having realized in this four hour movie, by the way,
yes,
one of the all time greatest films of ever made in this country. 4 hours. Michael finds out that his brother Fredo is the one who betrayed him and takes him out to the lake house, which I think is on Lake Tahoe. But really, he's just building up to having his own brother whacked. And Fredo is the one sitting in that Adirondack type chair with John Cazale, like in this sunken posture, flopped down there. And Michael is looking out on the water, similar to how Pacino is when we see him as Hoffa in this movie. All of these little references are building up to put you in the mind of other mob movies that these men had made. But now in this totally different context, with this totally different like tension and tempo of older men looking back on their lives and being reflective and being wistful. And Frank's reflection is Scorsese's reflection, looking back on not just being a gangster, but looking back just on his life. Like if you took the last half hour of the movie and separated it from everything that came prior and put it at the end of a movie about a guy who, I don't know, worked at a lumber mill or sold insurance, it would have roughly the same weight. I feel like that's what he really wanted to do. He really wanted to tell a story about age and about looking back and about facing the grave and about thinking about all the things that it's too late for you to change. And because it's all too permanent now. That's the stuff that the movie's really about. That's why it doesn't feel exciting or thrilling or romanticized in any way, because it's just about work. And mob is just a genre structure for him to tell a story about work and career and family and friendship and betrayal and regret accumulated over a huge lifespan.
Right. I see what you're saying, although I do dispute the idea that it would have the same weight at the end of a movie about a career guy in like a nonviolent career.
Well, sure, because that wouldn't be very exciting.
No, it's not that it wouldn't be very exciting. Like a nonviolent career doesn't have, there is weight added by taking people's lives.
But Frank doesn't feel that weight.
He does when it's Hoffa. He does when it's Hoffa, and he also does when he's cut out of his daughter Anna Paquin's life and when his other daughter tells him why. I feel like I saw it on his face that like, oh, this wasn't just a job. Like I was actually doing bad things.
I don't think he feels any remorse whatsoever for any of it. I mean, like when he sits down with the priest, which is after those scenes with his daughters.
Yeah.
And the only thing that he can even articulate is what kind of man makes a phone call like that, referencing his phone call to Joe Hoffa, pretending that he has no idea what's happened to Jimmy when really he's the one who fucking blew his brains out all over a wall.
Right.
I think that's the only remorse that he feels. I think maybe he feels remorse for having killed Hoffa, but what he feels remorse for is the betrayal. He is so loyal the entire goddamn movie. He's loyal to Buffalino and he's loyal to Hoffa up until the point where those two loyalties come to heads. And then it comes down to like, well, which one of these people is going to murder me if I go against them? And he just doesn't have any choice. He has to go with Russell.
Okay. So what part of all of this that we've been circling is iconoclastic?
It's iconoclastic for someone to look at their own body of work, which for Scorsese is a towering body of work. The movies that he references, not only his own films, he's talking about these like landmark pieces of American popular culture and cinema. And he's looking back on them with an old man's eyes who feels like he has one foot in the grave and saying, at the end of all of that, I have nothing. And this is my interpretation of the movie. But after all of that depicting bloodshed and violence, and after all of just the work, right? Not even just those movies. I think he's talking about his entire body of work and his entire life. What do we have left at the end? He's not calling out, but he is questioning, what does it really matter if at the end of the day, like all people, we will die alone and weak and enfeebled and not remembering things and just feeling pain and guilt? It's deeply upsetting and distressing.
It is. Although to hear you describe it that way, I don't know. We're talking about a filmmaker of massive import who has undeniably, even to himself, created some of the most influential films in American cinema. And to compare that body of work to the work of someone just taking lives, I don't think it follows. that level of despair that Frank feels at the end, he did it to himself. Nobody made it there with him because either he killed them or they went to jail and died themselves.
But that's you projecting onto Frank. Frank feels no remorse for any of the killings. That's what made him such a good murderer.
Sure. However, he undeniably, factually, is alone due to his own doing.
Yeah.
He didn't foster a community. He didn't foster a body of work that would carry forward with him. And he actively isolated himself. Scorsese has a body of work.
He does have a body of work. But when his time comes, his body of work will not be there with him as he's picking out a coffin, as Frank has to do in the movie. His body of work will not be there with him when he's sitting in a wheelchair being confronted in this movie. It's by the police. For Scorsese, it's going to be interviewers, right? Frank doesn't even remember that his lawyer was dead. He doesn't even know that all these other people are dead because he's almost dead. That's the whole point.
To hear you say it like that, it feels like a false equivalence because Scorsese is going to, no matter, like, sure, maybe he'll feel alone or isolated or senile, he'll be doing it in a multi-million dollar mansion,
right,
and not a budget nursing home.
Right.
He will have people around him who care about him. He's got family, yes.
He has family.
These two things are not the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing. But that's why we tell stories. And that's why we tell stories in genres. So you can take things that are not familiar or recognizable to your own experience and you can find things to empathize with them. That's what I'm saying. Like, you could take the last half hour of the movie and attach it to a more mundane, nonviolent story of somebody's life beforehand.
Right.
And I feel like it would still carry the same weight because of how invested Scorsese is in all of his characters. Like, one of his magic tricks as a director is that he is empathetic with all of his characters. He loves all of them. And if he judges them, the judgment never comes through on screen. He never looks down on his characters. He lets his bastard characters be funny, and he lets his, like, sweetest, most moralizing characters be shitty and selfish and greedy and venal. I'm not saying he made this movie to think, like, I am just like Frank Sheeran and I killed and betrayed my friends, or that my work as a filmmaker is just as bad or equivalent to what this man did. I'm saying he empathizes with it and that he told this story because he wanted to tell that last half hour, because he wanted to talk about looking back.
That makes a lot more sense to me.
I feel like I articulated that fairly well.
We shall see.
No one people, will know.
The people the shall wiser. Decide.
The people shall decide. We've talked about all the words,
yes,
all of your fucking overly intellectual, removed from the actual experience of the wine, descriptors, yes, for the pairing. Do we think it actually pairs? I'm going to tell you right now, I enjoyed the wine while I was watching The Irishman. This wine is not The Irishman.
No, it is not The Irishman.
It is not The Irishman.
But it is an enjoyable experience. I think that that any wine that evokes the intellectual experience of this movie would make the viewing experience a fucking slog.
Yeah.
It would be unpleasant.
Yeah. I was thinking what would go well with this movie would be like some fucking dark red, almost purple, like fucking grape juice that they're dipping their bread in at various points, right, in the movie. This is not that.
No, nor should it be, because drinking that without any food, or like just drinking that, which is likely a high alcohol situation, through a 3.5 hour experience,
would, like, be very unpleasant.
So unpleasant.
Yeah.
So very unpleasant.
My stomach hurts just thinking about
it. You kind of need something light. And I enjoyed the shit out of myself.
I think it worked very well.
Yeah. Like, it's not a synesthetic experience,
no,
necessarily. Like, there aren't link ups, but.
No, because there's nothing. The only thing that's sweet and, like, fruitful in the movie is the relationship between Frank and Hoffa. They have almost like an old married couple vibe.
They
at
do.
Times. They have a beautiful, like, tender relationship. Otherwise, there's almost no sweetness and no fruit forwardness in the movie.
Not even with his kids.
No.
We didn't even talk about how Anna Paquin has, like, one line of dialogue.
Oh, Jamie, fucking stay off of Twitter, okay? Just stop.
I was
just stop
not
with
on
that.
Twitter. I'm not complaining.
Okay, good.
I'm saying her performance is magnificent.
Great.
Even good. Though she only has
right.
one line of dialogue. Your initial instinct is like, oh, you've underutilized a really talented actress.
Right.
Except no, who else could give those withering looks?
She gives the fourth most important performance in the movie, and she is in four scenes and has one line of dialogue the entire time.
One line.
It is an amazing performance. So the reason I bring up Twitter is that...
Don't always jump to the conclusion that I'm on the side of the fucking neckbeards on Twitter.
Twitter got a Twitter, Jamie. And a lot of people got up in arms about this movie because they think that representation means equal screen time and equal lines of dialogue. And they're like, oh my God, Anna Paquin doesn't have any dialogue in the movie and barely has any screen time. That makes the movie sexist. And it's like, well, her not having dialogue is an intentional and extremely affected, pointed choice.
Yep.
It's Frank looking back and telling his story. And the only things he remembers his daughter saying to him are, it's the one line earlier when she's a little girl and when he's going out to do work and he's getting guns and she sees him through the crack in the door and she's like, where are you going? And then later on, after Hoffa's dead and Frank says, oh, I haven't called his widow or I haven't called Joe yet. Why she's like, why? Joe? Why haven't you called him? That line that just rips his guts out and the character never recovers from it. You don't need her to have any more dialogue, but also it's like that's Frank's recollection of her. He can't get past that moment. The only thing he can remember in their relationship is her judging him and thinking so little of him and cutting him to the one thing in his life that he feels guilty about.
The argument that the movie is sexist because Anna Paquin gets very little screen time, I don't think is good.
It's pretty dumb.
The good argument is maybe in 2021, we don't need to be spending $150 million on more movies about old white men. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm not saying it shouldn't have been made. However, there is representation disparity.
There is.
Hundreds of millions of dollars for more white man content is maybe not necessary.
I will counter that with that is not Scorsese's responsibility. He made like a towering work of art, and I think it's okay.
The second part I agree with more. The first part, it is a little bit his responsibility. He has a huge amount of power and influence, and for him to take on a topic that is more representational would send a signal and have reverberations through the industry.
No, I see. I think you're completely wrong. He shouldn't be the one telling those stories. Other people should tell those stories, and other people should be given the resources and the platform to tell those stories. You let Martin Scorsese tell whatever the fuck story he wants to about whatever old white man that he can. You have to level the playing field so that other people can tell those stories.
Okay, yeah, I'll accept that. Moving right along.
Pairing.
I think we covered it. This movie needed something light. It needed something easy. It needed something uncomplicated that was made for the masses.
Yeah.
This wine is exactly that. And while I don't think that there are moments in the movie where the wine accentuates or dulls anything particular and vice versa, I found the experience of both together to be very pleasant.
It kind of dulled the pain a little bit.
Which we kind of needed.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like from the, once Russell makes it clear that Frank has to go and kill Jimmy and he's on the plane and it's fatalistic. It's inevitable. We know that we're going to that point anyway. Yeah. And then he hugs him in the car. It just wrecks you. And then it's just this falling grace after that. I needed a wine that was easy and uncomplicated that I could just keep fucking throwing back because it just broke my heart.
Yeah. It's a good movie. It's a good wine.
It's extremely good. The wine is also good. I like it a lot. I highly recommend. People should check it out.
Probably the easiest wine for our viewers to get on a consistent basis.
Love Drunk.
Love
Maison
Drunk
Rosé. Noir.
Yep.
And they make this every year.
They sure do.
And it's very popular.
Very.
All right. Jamie, we don't have any new reviews this week.
It's a bummer, guys. You should review us on the Apple Pods.
On the Apple Pods.
We could use reviews. We need validation and attention, which is obviously why we're speaking into microphones right now.
That is correct.
But also, you could get validation and attention because we'll read your review on air.
Yeah, and as long as you're not Johnny Words and you don't write a fucking dissertation in which you insult us a bunch, like we won't even make fun of you while we read it on
the
air.
That's correct. Okie dokie, next time on.
Next time on. Jamie, what is in part 3 of Jim Jam's U.S. Vino History Times?
All right, we're going a little south of Oregon to California. We're doing Dash Cellars Vineyard Select Zinfandel.
Dash Cellars Vineyard Select Zinfandel.
That's correct.
How did you describe this wine to me?
Refined technique, time machine, mouth filling, parentheses, a mouthful.
Mm.
And urban.
Do we have to say mouth filling? Can we say something other than mouth filling?
Nope.
Okay. Are you sure?
I like the look on your face, like when a cat smells something bad.
Yeah, this doesn't smell good to me. I don't like Jamie saying mouth filling. I don't like the way I sound saying mouth filling.
This wine is mouth filling.
So, based on refined technique, time machine, mouth filling, and urban, I have selected one of my favorite movies of recent years. This is a documentary that is currently streaming on Hulu. It's called Minding the Gap. This is from director Bing Liu, his first feature film, and it is a documentary about himself and two of his childhood friends who are all skater punks, and you follow them over the years as they grow up. Bing Liu's like skating photography is exquisite and super exciting and fun to watch, and then it reveals itself to be something more. If you do not watch documentaries, please watch this movie anyway. It's such a great, humane, empathetic story. I cannot imagine anyone not loving these three young men that are depicted in the movie. I will say, content warning, there are discussions of childhood trauma and child abuse. So if that is a trigger for you, you have been warned. It devastated me in the best possible way when I saw it for the first time earlier this year. It is currently on the Hulu, Minding the Gap from director Bing Liu. Please check it out. I really think everybody will love it.
I'm down. That sounds great.
Yeah. All right, Jamie. Let's take it home. Let's wrap it up.
Bringing it home.
The people are tired.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any questions at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Please make sure, once again, to rate, review, and follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by me, and Jamie does all of our social media.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
We do promise. But drink responsibly, as always. Also, Jamie's new house is nice.
It's really nice. I like it here.
All right, I have no funny sign-off. Good night, everyone. Good night, Jamie.
Godspeed.
We out.